Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Rebecca, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Institute offers paid internships for students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, our nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or online at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The Fiscal Cliff and Other Horror Stories on the Debt and the Deficit. I will now turn the time over to Norm Waitzman, who will introduce our guest. Norm?
Well, thanks, Rebecca. And it's my pleasure and distinct privilege to introduce Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Dean, you're going to have to forgive the audience today. They're still a bit ornery from the election last week, where a homegrown candidate did not win. That's Rocky Anderson, of course. And in Utah, the orneriness means that a few minutes are generally lopped off from the usual standing ovation. Dean and I actually were classmates at Swarthmore College way back when. I think I was a few years actually ahead in my program. We both shared an interest in addressing the pressing economic problems of the day, macro crisis, poverty, inequality. And I think we also shared a bit perplexed by the economics discipline in relation to those problems. In one of Gulliver's lesser-known travels, he happens upon Laputa. Those who know Spanish can chuckle. Populated by Laputians, who were nerdish folks with slanted heads, steeped in mathematics, and they needed flappers to smack them to keep them focused on the issue of the moment. And they couldn't even use their superior mathematics and their IQ to build even a stable house. All high-powered, little practical relevance, all brain, no heart. Today, we call these disreputable breed economists. Dean Baker has steered unwaveringly against this disreputable tide. He's architected a center in D.C. that is frequently called upon by the national media for perspective on pressing issues of the day, particularly related to the nature of economic crisis and the improper and proper roles of government and business and how they ought to interact. You likely have seen him on NewsHour or have heard him on NPR or read him in the New York Times or in the Washington Post or in many other outlets. He's written several books, including the latest, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Other books include Social Security, The Phony Crisis, and another, the conservative nanny state, related to how basically the wealthy rip us off. His work has helped lift the blinders that plague our discipline. His prescience has reached even mythic levels. At the height of the housing bubble, while Greenspan was waxing about a bit of froth in the system, Dean Baker, I've been told, sold his house. Don't burst that bubble for us. Today he's brought us some fiscal cliff notes, which promises to get to the very heart of the matter. Without further ado, Dean Baker.
Well, thanks, Rebecca and Norm and the other people who organized this, and it's an honor to be here. Norm mentioning my days at Swarthmore together, I have to say it's unfortunately longer than I think both of us would like to believe. But the other thing that's depressing was I don't think either of us envisioned where we'd be today 30, 35 years ago. I think we thought things would go in a somewhat different direction. But we're still hopeful. That's all you could be. Okay, anyhow, so what I want to get talk I want to cover today, if I could advance this. There we go. Okay, good. That's where I think I went too far. Okay. Okay, main points that I wanted to say. First off, that the fiscal cliff's an invented crisis, and I'm really struck by this, to what extent this has been built up as a crisis. I don't ordinarily read USA Today, but I stayed in the guest house here and got USA Today delivered to my doorstep. And any of you might have happened to look at it, you saw big front page story, fiscal cliff, what happens if we go over? So I'm going to tell you basically what happens if we go over is nothing. Second point, that the near-term deficits were caused by the collapse of the economy, which is in turn caused by a collapse of the housing bubble. So we have this bizarre story. Reason why we have large deficits today, very simple. The economy collapsed. So what do we do? Do we worry about the collapsed economy? No, we worry about the large deficits. That's close to crazy, at least in my view. The third point, that longer term, if you look out 10, 15, 20 years, you can tell a story about deficits being large. But this is entirely a story of healthcare costs. Healthcare costs drive the deficit because public sector healthcare programs, the two big ones, Medicare and Medicaid, healthcare costs go up. We buy our healthcare in the private sector, even if we pay for it through the public sector. That means Medicare and Medicaid become very expensive. We have large deficits. So the story that I'm going to tell you is we should be talking about our healthcare system, not talking about the deficits. Okay, main story of fiscal cliff. First, what is it? This is $500 billion, roughly, give or take some, in terms of expiring tax cuts. The main story, the largest portion of that, the Bush tax cuts, when he lowered the income tax rates back in 2002, 10% reduction in income tax rates across the board. Those were put in place for 10 years. They're supposed to expire in 2010. Because the economy was still in a downturn, you had a standoff between President Obama and Congress, they agreed to extend them another 2 years. President Obama would like to extend the tax cuts for the bottom 98% of the population. The Republicans in Congress say no, they want to extend it for everyone, including the top 2%. In addition to that, you have the payroll tax cut. That's about $130 billion. We're all paying payroll tax. 4.2 percentage points instead of 6.2 percentage points of our wages. That ends at the end of this year. There's other tax cuts, the alternative minimum tax, a lot of little tax fix. I won't go into detail on those, but all of those end at the end of 2012, so you'd be paying a higher tax rate for those reasons as well. In terms of spending, we also have $110 billion as a sequester. Half of that's on the military side, half of it on domestic discretionary. This was the budget deal that Congress and President Obama agreed to in the summer of 2011 to extend the debt ceiling. I didn't list this here, but it's actually a very important item that I should mention. Extended unemployment benefits, that normally unemployment benefits go for 26 weeks. Because of the downturn, they were extended and then extended again, so that in many states you collect benefits for up to 97 weeks. If that's not extended, if that period of extension isn't continued past January 1st, that would fall back to 26 weeks in every state. So that would both be a big hit to people who have been unemployed for long periods of time. A lot of people still in that boat. Also, it's a big hit to the economy. So, again, I should have listed that. It is an important item. Okay, so what happens if we don't do anything? Well, there's been a lot of reports, and, again, you would have gotten this if you looked at your USA Today and saw the big front page graph. You'd see that the unemployment rate goes – we go back into a recession. The unemployment rate goes up to above 10%. By many estimates, including Congressional Budget Office, it knocks off about 3.6 percentage points from growth. I think that was the CBO estimate. Okay, well, that might get you really scared, and if you believe that, that should get you really scared. Okay, what actually happens? Here's why you shouldn't be scared. What actually happens come January 1st, workers are subject to higher withholdings. Okay, what does that mean? Well, if you got paid January 1st, you'd have more money coming out of your paycheck for January 1st. Most of us won't get paid on January 1st. What this means is that if nothing is done over the course of the month, people get paid the middle of the month, they'll get paid at the end of the month, they will have more money taken out of their paycheck. Okay, January 1st, what happens? Well, pretty much nothing in terms of taxes. Very few people are getting paid January 1st, and even if you did get paid by the day, odds are that wouldn't be that much money. The point here is that this would take effect through time in terms of the tax bill. So when you just saw, you know, what I was referring to a moment ago, the big hit to the economy, the unemployment rate going over 10%, losing 3.6 percentage points of GDP growth, going back into recession. Those are all projections that were based on those higher taxes taking effect all year, not going over the cliff into January 1st, January 10th, January 15th. On the tax side, what we probably would expect to happen is, well, people would, if we don't see an agreement in the middle of the month, the end of the month, they would see more taxes coming out of their paycheck. How would that affect the economy? Well, if they expect there to be a deal with Congress, say at the end of the month or in February, where they probably would get all the extra taxes refunded to them, well, according to an awful lot of economic analysis and economic theory, the impact would be pretty much zero. In other words, how many people are really going to change their consumption habits, you know, in January because, you know, they had money taken out of their paycheck that they're going to get back next month? Probably most people won't change their habits at all. Now, I don't mean to be too cryptic about this because I understand you do people are living literally paycheck to paycheck. So if they have an extra $50 come out of their paycheck in January, that's going to be a hit. That's not going to be nice. Okay, but that's not most people in the economy. And what I'd have to say is, you know, realistically, the impact for those people is not going to have that much of an impact on the economy as a whole. So in other words, you'll have some people who are badly hurt, but in terms of its overall economic impact, that would be relatively modest. The spending side, what happens in spending? Well, odds are almost nothing happens in spending. What the sequester literally means is that Congress has to appropriate money at a slower rate come January than it did previously. Appropriations, I won't get too much into the nerddom of budgetry and everything. I'm not an expert in the nerddom in any case, but what actually matters in terms of the economy is outlays, not appropriations. And the distinction here is we're going to have appropriations that take place in 2013 for things like bombers or building new airports. These, you're actually going to see the outlays, the spending for that in 2015, 16, 17, 18. Practical matter, if President Obama expects there to be a deal with Congress sometime in January or February, he probably wouldn't adjust the rate of spending at all. Okay, so in terms of the spending side, there'd probably be almost no impact. Now, the one exception, again, this gets back to something that would hit a lot of people, the impact to the economy wouldn't be that much, if you didn't get a deal on extending unemployment benefits. So if we get to January 1st, January 10th, 15th, 20th, benefits will have stopped for a lot of people. Again, the aggregate impact on that, what's the impact of that in the economy? It's probably not that large. You know, those checks aren't that big. It will mean a lot to those people. The impact on the economy will be relatively minor. Okay, so if you go look through the various components of the fiscal cliff, you go, well, what's the impact of that? Basically pretty minor. Okay, I jumped ahead of my slide here. But the basic point is that if it ends up being the case that we get to January 1st and there's no deal, the impact of that for the economy is not going to be great. Now, what actually happens, and you know, everyone's got their own guesses, and my guess isn't necessarily better than anyone else's, but I think almost everyone you talk to would agree on this, that if you got to January 1st and there were no deal, you'd see Congress and the President work very hard to get a deal because no one wants to see higher tax rates applied to the whole country for the whole year. In other words, no one wants to see repeal of the Bush tax cuts for everyone through the whole year. And you'd probably get some deal on the sequester. Now, you won't get everything in the sequester. I put down $110 billion. That's the amount that's supposed to be pulled out of the flow of spending in 2013. You probably won't get all of that put back because Congress wants to reduce the deficit. I don't think that's a clever thing to do given where the economy is, but that's what they wanted to do. So that will be a hit to the economy, but that's not because of the cliff. That was because they want deficit reduction. When you're in the middle of a downturn and you want to reduce the deficit, you want slower growth and higher unemployment. That's what it means. So you can't blame the fiscal cliff for that. That was a decision of Congress to reduce the deficit. So we probably, at the end of the day, will see a deal that involves something less than the $110 billion. I don't have a crystal ball that tells me how that'll be broken down between the military and domestic spending, but you know, some of that out of each. You know, so maybe we'll have cuts of $50 billion, something like that. That will be a reduction, a negative impact for the economy. We'll probably see, my guess is, most of the tax cuts extended. The big thing that happens after January 1st, the reason why the date itself is so important, is that because the tax cuts expire after January 1st, you suddenly have a very different debate. Right now, what President Obama is saying, I want to raise taxes on the richest 2%. And the Republicans in Congress are saying, we don't want to raise taxes on anyone. Okay, so that's the debate right now. after January 1st, what President Obama is saying, I want to reduce taxes on 98% of the people. And my guess, and again, anyone else's guess is as good as mine on this, my guess is that's going to be very difficult for the Republicans to resist. So at that point, President Obama could say, I'm proposing a tax cut for 98% of the public, and the Republicans in Congress are preventing that from happening. In that terrain, my guess is that at the end of the day, you get something that's pretty close, not to say he doesn't make some compromise, but you know, probably something pretty close to a tax cut for 98%, restoring the Bush tax cuts for 98% of the people. Now, the other items, very much up for grabs. You know, if you don't extend the payroll tax cut or something like that, there's lots of reasons not to like the payroll tax cut, to my mind, first and foremost, because it does raise questions about the Social Security Trust Fund that traditionally has been designated for Social Security. They do replace it from general revenue, but traditionally Social Security has been financed exclusively through the payroll tax, so that does raise an issue there. But if you don't replace that with something like that, that will be somewhat of a hit to the economy. Most estimates are with slow GDP growth by 6 to 7 tenths of a percentage point. Bad news in a downturn that probably translates into losses somewhere around 600,000 to 700,000 jobs, or if you like, 600,000 to 700,000 fewer jobs being created. Unemployment benefits, again, no great crystal ball. My guess is that you don't see it extended the full amount. You don't see the 97 weeks, probably at least 52 weeks, because we still, you know, anyone would agree, we still have unusually high unemployment, and to simply cut it back to the 26 weeks that we would have during a period of prosperity, I think would be a very harsh blow, and I think even most Republicans would agree with that. So my guess is a partial extension. Okay, so long and short, let me just back up and stay on that slide for a second. Long and short is that there's no real consequence from going over the cliff at January 1st. The budget deal probably, the final deal probably will end up being somewhat contractionary, not as contractionary as the cliff, not the recession story. But again, that's by design. If you want deficit reduction, you want to slow, you may not think you want to slow the economy, but in reality, you do want to slow the economy because that's what's logically implied. Okay, point about the deficit. What I graphed here is the actual deficit, that's the blue line. And then I show the projections from the Congressional Budget Office as of January 2008. And I've been trotting this around lately. I just made this up about 6 months ago because I was talking about this all the time. People were looking at me like, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. We had this huge, huge deficit and, you know, this chronic deficit and, you know, Congress is just spending money all over the place. Or if you want, you can talk to the Democrats. Oh, the Bush tax cuts, you know, they pissed away the surplus, and now we have these huge deficits. Well, the reality is both those are not really true. And what I'm showing here, these were the deficits as a share of GDP before the economy collapsed. So 2006, it's about 1.7% of GDP. 2007, it was about 1.2% of GDP, if I had it more precisely. 2008, it was projected to stay around there, 1.3, 1.4% of GDP. Stays, you know, less than 2% of GDP. You know, through 2009, 2010, it goes towards zero and shifts into surplus 2012. Well, that's the ending of the Bush tax cuts. Okay, the Bush tax cuts were originally expected to expire at the end of 2010. These are fiscal years, not calendar years, so you don't see the full impact of that until 2012, at which point the government's projected to go into surplus. Okay, well, the point here is that the deficits were relatively modest. You know, how long could we run a deficit of 1.2, 1.3% GDP, or for that matter, 1.7? Anyone know how long we could run a deficit of that size? Any answers?
Indefinitely.
Indefinitely. We could run forever. The debt-to-GDP ratio is falling. Okay? You know, you could say the deficit's too big. I mean, anyone's free to argue, you know, there's advantages to having a balanced budget or even a surplus when the economy's near full employment. You can make that argument, but there was nothing unsustainable about those deficits. You couldn't say, oh, Congress was spending us into this huge hole and, you know, the ship of state was going down. That's nonsense. None of that was happening. When did that start happening where we had really large deficits? Well, that started happening when the economy collapsed. January 2008, my reason for picking that, the recession began in 2007. The housing bubble had already collapsed, but the Congressional Budget Office didn't realize its impact. Okay, so they made projections that assumed the economy was still on track to, you know, keep at, we had about 4.5% unemployment. We're still going to have 4.5% unemployment through 2008, 9, 10. They thought the economy was just going to keep going. Had that been the case, you know, those deficit numbers probably pretty close to right. But, of course, what happened was, you know, the economy collapsed, the deficit soared. Well, the deficit soared because when the economy collapsed, first and foremost, revenues go through the floor. And if you look at the biggest difference between what was projected you know, back in 2008, where we are today. Biggest difference is on the revenue side. It's not on the spending side. Okay, so most of the increase in deficits on the revenue side. It was both because we lost revenue, because we always lose revenue when the economy goes down, but also we had temporary tax cuts, like the original make-work-pay tax credit back in 2009, 2010, part of President Obama's original stimulus, and then also the payroll tax cut that was put in place last year. So we lose a lot of money on the tax side, and we did have the stimulus. And the reason for the stimulus, of course, was because the economy had collapsed. If you actually look at new spending programs, you will not find much. Okay, you could point to President Obama's health care reform, but the actual spending for that 2010, 2011, 2012 is really small. And even when we do start spending for it, 2014, 15, when the exchange is when it really starts to kick in, most of that's covered with new tax revenue. So again, you may not like the revenue, you may not like the health care reform, but the point is it really doesn't add to the deficit. In fact, it actually reduces the deficit slightly. Okay, so this isn't a story of out-of-control spending. It's not a story that, you know, we gave out huge tax breaks we couldn't afford. It's a story, very simply, the economy collapsed and gave us a very large deficit. Okay, which is why I say the short-term story, we're focused on the wrong issue. If we're really upset about the deficit, we should be focused on getting the economy back together. Okay, why'd the economy collapse? This is house prices. I should update this slide. I was just being lazy. This is, I go through 2010. It wouldn't show you anything very different. House prices fell a little bit more since 2010. The point of this slide, though, is house prices. These are nationwide. This is a 20-city index. So these are 20 large cities, large metropolitan areas, give you a cross-section of the country. And these are adjusted for inflation. Okay, so this is inflation-adjusted house prices. And what they show is that house prices pretty much kept even with the inflation until the mid-90s, the inflation rate. They began to rise more rapidly than inflation mid-90s, interestingly coinciding with the stock bubble. Okay, I point to this because there was a similar story in Japan with the housing bubble in the 80s coinciding with the stock bubble. Peaks in 2006, at that point, we had about $8 trillion in what I consider housing bubble wealth. That's the gap between if house prices had kept at their long-term trend and what they actually were at in 2006. Now, let me just make an additional point. I could give you different graphs. I don't know how many different graphs I have showing the same thing. But you could get government data going back to 1950. And you see, even if you go back to 1950, real house prices had stayed pretty much constant. And again, let me just emphasize, this is nationwide. So many people could point areas, you know, you can go to the West Coast. House prices have gone through the roof on the West Coast, even adjusting for inflation. New York area, gone through the roof. I have friends that, you know, our families got middle-class houses when they were little kids that go for over $1 million today, you know. So you could find areas like that. But then you find other areas like Detroit where you can get a middle-class house for $15,000. Okay, so you have places that went both ways. So you pull that average together, and it pretty much kept pace with the overall rate of inflation. Now, I have that from 1950 to 1996 using government data. There's an economist at Yale University, Robert Shiller, a very prominent finance economist. He constructed his own data set going back to the 1890s. And he has from 1890s to the mid-1990s, nationwide house prices just kept pace with the overall rate of inflation. Okay, my reason for emphasizing this is that it should have raised some eyebrows when you suddenly saw house prices go through the roof beginning in the late 90s and at its peak rising by more than 70% above the overall rate of inflation. The U.S. housing market is the biggest market in the world. And 100 years is a really long time trend. We're really happy when we've got, you know, 30 years to look back on. We had 100 years to look back on, huge market. And again, my reason for emphasizing it's a huge market. You don't expect unusual erratic movements in a huge market, a small market. You know, if we're looking at the market for barley or platinum or something, you know, some rich guy might be trying to manipulate the market, or, you know, some weird weather event. There's all sorts of things that happen in those little markets. So if you look at, you know, one of the smaller markets, you'll see, you know, prices go up 50% one year and down by 30%. And, you know, they move in erratic ways. Big markets don't tend to move in erratic ways. So you saw this huge run-up in house prices, and there was no real story in the fundamentals. So you couldn't really tell a story. You know, demand side of the market was, you know, was this a period of robust income growth? You could say that a little bit in the 90s, although it wasn't that robust. I mean, the late 90s were a good time, but they're no better in the 50s and 60s, and we didn't have anything resembling that. You couldn't tell population growth. You know, if you wanted to tell population growth, you probably want to tell that story, you know, when people like me and Norman were first, you know, starting our own households, the baby boom generation, you know, in the 70s and 80s. Didn't happen then. You know, by, you know, the end of the 90s, 2000, baby boomers' kids are moving out. They're downsizing. That doesn't fit, you know. On the supply side, well, we're building homes at a near record rate. Okay, and, you know, if you want a check on this, we could look at what was going on in rents. You know, you expect the rental market and sale market to move, you know, more or less in the same general direction, not necessarily one-to-one. But if we're really seeing pressure on the housing market, that demand is hugely exceeding supply, as this bubble would seem to imply, or this run-up in prices would seem to imply, you expect to see some increase in rental markets. So what's going on with rents? Answer, nothing. Rents increased a hair more in the rate of inflation in the late 90s, like 1% a year, 1 percentage point a year. The last decade, 2000, 2007, 2008, when the bubble collapsed, they kept right even with the rate of inflation. So you didn't have any story at all. In other words, I'm just saying we should be really, really mad at people like Alan Greenspan and other people in policy positions for ignoring this, because it should have been evident to them. All the signs were there. There was really no other story you could have other than this was just a bubble. The other point I just make is, you know, just to put this in some historical context, because this is getting a little distant, the idea that we would have bubbles shouldn't have been alien to people in 2003. Anyone know why it shouldn't have been alien to people? Just analysts, just stock bubble. You know, stock. We lost $10 trillion when the stock bubble collapsed in 2000, 2002. It lost $10 trillion in value. Now, they eventually recouped most of that. But we had a very big bubble there, and it burst, and, you know, that had a big impact on the economy. So the idea that we might have bubbles shouldn't have been alien to people like Alan Greenspan. We had just seen one. Okay, so what was the story of the bubble? Well, the bubble was driving the economy. That's why it matters. I have all these people, you know, sending me emails, oh, you think there's a bubble in, you know, the platinum market? So, you know, I don't know. I don't look at those markets. But the reason why it matters when you have a bubble in the housing market is it does affect the economy as a whole. So we had near record rates of construction 2002 to 2006. Again, it was anomaly. You know, this doesn't. We didn't have this big growth in the economy. It didn't make any sense. We had record vacancy rates. But people were building because house prices were very high. So it gave us $300 to $400 billion in additional demand in residential construction. Secondly, consumption. People spend based on the wealth of their home. That's not a secret, at least not to economists. We have, you know, when I was in grad school, it was already old. I don't know when people first wrote on this, but, you know, back in the early 80s, this was all well-known, accepted theory, the housing wealth effect. People spend $5 to $7 on the dollar with housing wealth. So if you have $8 trillion in bubble-generated wealth, well, that translates to $400 to $600 billion a year in additional consumption. People are spending based on the wealth in their home. You know, so what might mean is that they're not putting money in a 401k because retirement account because the house is doing it for them, or they might be pulling equity out. A lot of people are doing that. Not necessarily a bad thing to do if the equity stays there. It is a bad thing to do, of course, if the equity vanishes. So a lot of people are doing that. The third part of the story was there was a bubble in the non-residential real estate market. So we saw this huge boom in construction of office space, retail space, other types of non-residential construction that followed almost directly as the housing bubble itself began to reside somewhat. You saw a huge boom in non-residential construction. Okay, so what does that look like after it burst? Well, we lose the demand in residential construction. That's the top bar there. That's about $600 billion a year, and we go back not just to normal levels of construction, but way below normal levels of construction. We're building new homes at about the same pace as we did in the 50s, early 60s, and that was simply because we had enormous oversupply. So we lost about 4 percentage points of demand, 4 percentage points of GDP. That's about $600 billion a year in annual demand because housing construction fell through the floor. Second part of the story, consumption. We lost around $500 to $600 billion a year in annual consumption demand because the wealth that it was based on, the housing wealth, had disappeared. Okay, so you had all this housing wealth driving consumption. The wealth disappears. Consumption falls back. The third part, non-residential construction, enormous oversupply. I don't know the story out here, but, you know, even in D.C., I'm saying even D.C. because D.C.'s doing relatively well in the scheme of things. Even D.C., you can go downtown prime real estate, huge signs for lease, you know, all this office space, retail space, and that's true much of the country. You'll find whole malls that were, you know, just finished and they're sitting there empty. So we had enormous overbuilding, as I say, most categories of non-residential. Then the last part is state and local demand. A lot of state and local governments were very hard hit. I don't know how Utah's fared, probably better than most places, but you know, certainly most places around the country, state and local governments were hit by a big fall in tax collections. Most governments have to balance their budget, so they had to make cutbacks in spending or tax increases, also drag on the economy. So total loss of demand, somewhere around $1.4, $1.5 trillion. That's, you know, these are squishy numbers. I'm not going to swear by that exact number, but, you know, gives you an order of magnitude. By contrast, out of the stimulus, now most of you probably hear the stimulus talked about as being $800 billion. What I'm interested in is annual demand. And first off, about $100 billion of the stimulus had nothing to do with stimulus. It was the alternative minimum tax. This is coming up now. This is a fix that they do every year. My reason for saying it's not stimulus is Congress does it every year. No one spent more money because they fixed the alternative minimum. Everyone, they always expect them to fix the alternative minimum tax. So that really didn't belong. It shouldn't have been counted as part of the stimulus. So what actually was the stimulus was around $700 billion. Now, some of that money is money being spent 2011, 12, 13, various infrastructure projects. That's fine. But if you go, how much were they actually spending because of the stimulus in 2009, 2010, spending our tax cuts, it was about $600 billion or about $300 billion a year. So my point in putting these side by side is that the stimulus was fine. It was, you know, it created about $300 billion in additional demand. Most estimates, Congressional Budget Office, other independent people have looked at this, they put the impact of stimulus as creating around 2 to 3 million jobs, all of which is well and good. Problem was we needed somewhere around 10 to 12 million. Okay, it simply was nowhere near large enough. And I should point out, none of this is, you know, 2020 hindsight looking after the fact. If you go back, and I don't quite know why Obama's team hasn't really made more of a point of publicizing this, and go back, you can look at the documents that they themselves put up on the website, on their website, before President Obama was even inaugurated. They laid out their basic plan for the stimulus in January 2009, before President Obama's even taken office. They expected to create 3 to 4 million jobs. Okay, they were anticipating a much smaller downturn. They didn't even get everything they asked for, but they were anticipating a much smaller downturn. All that's right in the document. So the problem with the stimulus was it didn't work. It worked. It just was nowhere near large enough. And as I say, all of that was, you know, really knowable at the time because it was all in black and white. It's none of it involves going backwards and sort of rewriting history. Okay, just to deal with a couple of the things that people often say that are wrong about the state of the economy. We often hear people say that, you know, well, one of the problems is people are nervous, consumers are holding on to their pocketbooks, they're heavily indebted, this and that. Well, what I've graphed here is consumption as a share of disposable income. Don't worry about adjusted consumption. That's a little technical, not worth going into. Just focus on the actual consumption. These are straight out of the national income accounts that the Commerce Department publishes. If you look at consumption as a share of disposable income, it's below the bubble peaks of, you know, 2002 to 2006. You know, it was close to 100%. It's also a little below the bubble peaks of the late 90s. But we're well above where we were in the earlier 90s, considerably above the 80s, 70s, 60s. People are actually still spending a very high share of their income. Okay, so the idea that everyone's very wary that, you know, they're not spending, if we could just make them more confident about the economy, it's simply not true. They're actually spending a very high share of their income. To my mind, a surprisingly high share of their income, especially when you have all these people running around Washington talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare. I'd go, you know, probably you want to save more. You know, you need something for retirement. Okay, the other part of the story, investment. You know, what's going on with investment? I focus on equipment and software. I don't have non-residential structures, and my reason is that we had the bubble there, you know. So, you know, you'd have to be crazy to build another mall when the last one was built is sitting there empty. Your office building, same thing. I mean, you don't really expect that. So that's still down somewhat from the pre-recession level. But if you look at investment equipment and structures, we aren't quite back to the pre-recession level, but we're pretty close. And we're above where we were in the early 90s and the 80s, you know, the Reagan morning in America, and we supposedly had a boom, which we really didn't. But, you know, if you look at investment levels then, we're pretty much back to where we were. So investment in equipment and software is actually doing pretty well. So the idea that firms are really pessimistic, they're uncertain about the future, and that's keeping them from investing, you know, they're actually investing pretty well. And if you look at this by sector, you know, what you find is that the biggest drag on investment is manufacturing, where we still have a huge amount of excess capacity. You know, so again, it's the same story. We don't expect firms to be investing a lot when their factories are half idle now. So we actually are doing pretty well in terms of equipment and software investment. Okay, so just to sort of summarize the story then, you know, we had this huge fall off in demand, It's not that consumers aren't spending enough. It's not that equipment, investment equipment and software is inadequate. The real problem is that we have a large trade deficit, and we don't have a way to make up that gap. Our trade deficit is currently about 4% of GDP. It's about $600 billion a year. If we had full employment, it would probably be about 5%, $750 billion a year. We need something else to fill that gap. In the short term, all we really have is government spending, government deficits. That's why I keep saying if you want to cut the deficit, you want slower growth, you want higher unemployment, because we don't have anything else to fill the gap. We don't have a story where something else jumps up from the private sector and fills the gap. So that's a short-term story. So that's why I say I'm a fan of deficits in the short term. Let me quickly go through the long-term story and then take some questions, because I know you all agree with what I said. But. Okay, the story, the debt as a percent of GDP. This is the scary story that, you know, I'm sure many of you have heard. You know, the debt to GDP ratio is going to get up near 90% by, you know, within a decade. We're supposed to be very worried about that. I like to show a somewhat different story. Interest as a share of GDP. Currently, the interest that we pay on the debt as a share of GDP is near a post-war low. Okay, we'd have to look at the latest numbers to see where we sit where relative to the early 70s. It was coming down, by the way. I didn't selectively pull that. It was coming down up to that point, so not going up. So we actually have very low interest burden. And if we're going to say, what's the drain on the federal government, well, it has to be the interest burden, not the actual size of the debt. And I'll just say a quick point and deal with questions if people are bothered by it. When we issue long-term bonds and interest rates rise, as people expect, you know, the economy will recover one of these days. I don't know when, but it will recover, and we'll presumably have higher long-term interest rates. People know what happened to bond prices when interest rates go up? They go down. So just to take an extreme case, you get 30-year treasuries. We're issuing 30-year treasuries at about 2.75% interest. Say it goes up to 6.5%, which isn't that high a rate. That's what was there in the 90s. The price of those bonds would fall by about 50%. So if we're really troubled by the debt, you know, and you go, well, we should focus on that last slide. I'm sorry. You know, the debt slide. Well, we could buy up $2 trillion of long-term bonds for $1 trillion and get rid of $1 trillion of our debt. So we should make everyone really happy. I mean, it'd be a silly thing to do, but if people are really worried about the debt, that would take care of it. So I would argue the interest burden is what we should really worry about. And we have to get, you know, some distance out before we even get an interest burden that's as high as what we had in the early 90s. You know, which again, I won't say it's trivial, but you know, we weren't at risk of going under in the early 90s, I would say. Okay, so last point, the healthcare point. We pay more than twice as much per person for our healthcare as the average of other wealthy countries. So my basic comparison, I'm not pulling up, you know, poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa. My basic comparison is Canada, Germany, UK, you know, countries we think is basically comparable to the US. We spend more than twice as much as the average for those countries. And we don't have anything obvious to show for it in terms of outcome. In fact, we rank near the bottom of life expectancy. I think Japan's more than 4 years longer than us. It's not huge gaps, but still, I think most of us would welcome 4 more years of life. So we rank near the bottom, and you know, you could be more detailed. There are some things we do better, so I'm not going to say it's a total disaster, but you'd be hard pressed to say we have a qualitatively better healthcare system. But we do pay more than twice as much per person. So what I did here is a very simple story. Here we said, suppose we paid the same amount per person as people. I have a low cost scenario. I won't go into that, but as people in Canada, that's our red line there. And people in the UK, what do those long-term deficit projections look like? Well, of course, the baseline, you see a deficit goes through the roof, you know, 30, 40% GDP, these outrageous deficits. Obviously, those would be devastating for the economy if we actually saw them. If we had the same healthcare costs per person as those other countries, we'd be looking at long-term budget surpluses. Okay, so it's not, you know, if we're worried about this long-term picture, huge deficits, it's a healthcare story. Okay, it's not that, you know, Medicare and Medicaid, you know, the government healthcare programs, you know, the cost of those are going through the roof. It's our healthcare costs in general are going through the roof, and for the most part, we're buying our healthcare in the private sector. So again, we have public sector programs, obviously Medicare, Medicaid are, the, you know, government programs, but they're buying healthcare in the private sector. So the reason why those costs are projected to go through the roof is because we expect private sector healthcare costs to go through the roof. In fact, Medicare and Medicaid both have generally, costs have generally risen less rapidly on a per-person basis than private sector costs. So we really should be talking about healthcare. That's really the long-term deficit story. And I'll just make one more point on that. There's actually good news in this front, or I think good news. I mean, I don't claim great expertise in this area. If you look at annual healthcare cost growth, most of the story here is the healthcare services. That's about two-thirds, private healthcare services. That's about two-thirds of healthcare spending, perhaps a bit more. There's been a sharp slowdown in growth in healthcare, in all healthcare costs over the last 4 years. Now, some of that's clearly related to the recession, no doubt about that. You know, people aren't able to afford healthcare. Even if they have insurance, a lot of people can't afford the co-pays. So no doubt a lot is due to that. But it's still quite extraordinary. And if you look at the last year, healthcare services, the cost of healthcare services, I don't have this graph because I don't have full year data, obviously, for 2012. But the last year, third quarter of 2011 and 2012, healthcare services only increased by 1.7%. That's less. That's nominal terms. That's less than the growth of GDP, considerably less, in fact. So my guess is that we actually are on a lower trend. You know, it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, when the economy recovers, we perhaps see somewhat more rapid healthcare cost growth than what, you know, we've seen the last few years, but well below what's been projected, which would certainly be very, very good news for the economy and also good news in terms of those deficit projections. So just to sum up, first point, the fiscal cliff, as I say, it's an invented crisis. There's no great downside, at least that I could see from, you know, waiting till January to get a deal. Again, if you went the whole year, no doubt about it, no dispute. If we're paying those higher tax rates for the whole year, that's going to be a very big hit to the economy, and we have the cuts in unemployment benefits and spending. That would be a very, very big hit. Secondly, the deficit that everyone's so excited about, it's because the economy collapsed. We didn't go on a spending spree. We didn't give out huge tax cuts. We could argue about spending. We could argue about taxes. But the reality is we have large deficits today because the economy collapsed. The third point, the long-term story, as I say, it's healthcare. We should talk about the healthcare system. If we fix healthcare, we don't have a long-term deficit problem. And the last point, you know, we have a problem with the economy. That's what we should be focused on. So I'll stop and take some questions.
If you do have a question, please state your name and speak directly into the microphone and say a little bit about yourself. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Curtis Miller. I'm a student here at the University of Utah studying economics. I recall a few months back, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke discussing the fiscal cliff and saying that he was very concerned about it, and he tried to convince Congress that they should try to avert this thing. So why is it that the Federal Reserve believes, or at least Ben Bernanke believes, that this is a problem?
Well, I'm hard-pressed to read Ben Bernanke's mind. I mean, I'm tempted to make some Ben Bernanke jokes. Like back in 2007, he said he thought the problems in the financial market would be restricted to the subprime sector. Or after Bear Stearns collapsed in March of 2008, he testified before Congress. He said, I don't see another Bear Stearns out there. You know, in other words, his judgment hasn't always been great. But, you know, again, you know, Ben Bernanke is a very good economist and very good political actor. So I can't speak to what exactly his motives were. Now, if his point is that if we leave the higher tax rates in place all year, the spending cuts in place all year, no doubt about it, that's going to be a very, very big hit to the economy, almost certainly throw us back into recession. If his point was just going over the January 1 deadline, it's hard to see, you know, what he could have in mind. And I remember the comment, and I don't remember what is, you know, the exact wording. So I don't remember whether he was specific about going over January 1st would be a disaster. I'm not sure that he had put it in those terms.
I'd like to thank you for your time today. And I saw a lot of conservative hearts breaking over you delegitimizing the crisis as you see it, or as it's been regarded. I've seen this repeated throughout American history. How many times do you feel that this could be a legitimate concern? I remember in 1994, the government shutting down over conflicts of this nature. And basically, my question to you is, how many times can we be faced with this crisis before we realize the sky isn't falling?
That's a really good question. You know, it's one of the things I do. I have a blog called Beat the Press, and it's analyzing economic reporting. And I've just been amazed, you know, reporters that do know better. I know many of these people. You know, I'm on decent terms with them. I mean, some of them I'm not on decent terms with, but some of them I am. You know, these are people I talk to. I talk to on the phone, we email. And they're going on about this crisis, and I'm going, what do you mean? Because it's not that they see a different reality. I mean, they do raise the issue, and I'll acknowledge it is an issue. I don't take it very seriously, but it's an issue. How do the markets react? You know, the financial markets react come January 1st. And my expectation is they react like everyone else will react. They're going to go, okay, so these guys are going to take 2 weeks into the new year to get a deal. So what? But, you know, they're saying, oh, no, they're going to panic. Well, you know, do you really have any basis for that? I made fun of a Washington Post reporter exactly for that this morning. He said they're going to panic. I go, you're really that much of an expert on markets. You could tell me that. And furthermore, I go, even if they do panic, the relationship between the financial markets and the U.S. economy is not that direct. And my case in point, role model here or example here is the crash in 87. You know, the stock market lost 25% of its value in a single day. It's hard to imagine more of a disruption than that. Now, it subsequently gained most of that, but, you know, that was a serious disruption. You look at what happened to the economy. Well, the economy grew 7% in the fourth quarter of the year. Now, there was impact, so I don't mean to say there was zero impact. You could look more carefully at the data and find an impact, but it didn't send the economy reeling. So you go, okay, what's your worst-case scenario? Because we all agree, it's almost inconceivable that, you know, Congress is going to take even through the month of January. But, you know, let's say they take to February, take some February 10th. The impact of that's almost zilch. So what they have to rely on is the financial markets are so jittery and this and that. So, all right, so they get really unnerved by the lack of a deal, and then we get a deal. Well, presumably they're all really happy, right? So the market, stock market plunges, however, whatever number you want to put there, 5%, 10%, 15%, and then it bounces back, you know? So some people, you know, they have a, you know, it's a roller coaster. It's not something I really want to see, but for most of it's not a disaster. Now, you know, you can tell some bad stories. There'll be people that'll get panicked and they'll sell their life saving that they have in the stock market at the bottom, and then they'll see it go right back up and they've just lost 15. You know, that's really unfortunate. But I wouldn't govern my economy based on the fact that some people are going to have bad judgment, the risk that some people have bad judgment in the stock market. So anyhow, the long and short is I really blame the media an enormous amount for this. And this is why I was jumping on, you know, front page story in USA Today, you know, that it jumps out. I mean, it's a big graph right across the center. And, you know, we really have to beat up on them. And you know, I'm doing my best, you know. But you know, the positive side of this is that we have much better mechanisms to do that today. I could have my blog and, you know, the reporters that know me, I could send them an email. The reporters that don't or don't want to talk to me, it's going to get back to them. And you could hold them on the carpet in a way that, you know, say wasn't true 15 years ago. I could send them an angry letter that, you know, gets thrown in the garbage. But, you know, we do have better means, you know. So you know, I don't know. We'll see how much they're able to get away with. They've been able to get away with more than I expected. But I think the media really does play a central role in this, and generally not a good one.
Hi, my name is Phil, and I'm an economics student here. And I had a question about, you said the long-term, really, budget problem is healthcare costs. And I know with Obamacare, I was really disappointed when they got rid of the option to do the single-payer system. And it seems to me, without that, there really aren't any options to help control those costs. But what do you think that we would need to help fix that?
Well, I would have loved to see... I mean, we'd love to see us go the lines of a universal Medicare system like Canada has. That clearly wasn't on the agenda from the word go. And even though I'd run out during the campaign, the idea of having a public option, it's clear, I mean, enough has come out about the negotiations. They abandoned that very quickly, you know, the White House, the President Obama's team. Absent that, you know, you may see some cost controls. Historically, the story with insurance companies has been they've not been effective in controlling costs simply because it's not a good way to compete for them. Their best way to compete is to avoid having sick people as customers. You know, that might be good for the insurance company. It's not very good for sick people. It's not good for containing health care costs. Will that change? Perhaps, you know, again, I'm pointing to the last 4 years where we've actually had slower growth. I won't claim to have a good analysis of why. I don't know if anyone does at this point. You may actually see enough constraint on cost growth. I mean, the reality has been a lot of the cost growth is just, you know, wasted technology. The best example that I do know a little about is in the case of prescription drugs. The growth of prescription drug spending has just plummeted. You know, the Republicans like to say, see, it was all because we did such a good job designing the Medicare drug benefit. And, you know, they point to the cost of the Medicare drug benefit were much lower than had been projected at the time they instituted it. And they say that's because, you know, they ran through the private insurers and they had great economies. Well, the cost of drugs in general has increased much less than was projected, and it's easy to show why. We've had much less drug innovation. You know, that's where most of the costs come from. Now, the reality is that much of the drug innovation that you do see isn't of much use. So companies come up with, you know, we have I don't know how many calcium channel blockers. You know, it's a very good, important drug for reducing the risk of heart attacks. But, you know, once you get the third, the fourth, the fifth, getting the sixth, seventh, eighth probably isn't of that much value. And a lot of the research that the drug companies do are aimed at that. Pushes up cost, but it provides very little in the way of benefit. Perhaps we're seeing more of a check on that, you know, whether that's because insurance companies are refusing to pay in many cases. Drug companies have cut back their research, I think, because they're sort of they've decided, I think, to focus more on marketing rather than research. Not necessarily good things, but, you know, it does seem like that's contained cost. Whether that will happen in the long run is hard to say. One of the points that I've made, and, you know, you could have mixed feelings on it, I think at the end of the day it's a good story rather than a bad story. If you actually had those projections of costs continue to go through the roof, we're going from a situation where our healthcare costs are, say, a little more than twice as much per person as the average of other countries to three, four, or five times as much. People aren't prisoners here. They will go to Canada, they will go to Germany, or they'll go to developing countries. People are already doing that. They'll do that in much larger numbers. That will be a check on cost. I mean, I don't think it's good that someone wants to get open heart surgery, goes to, you know, India or Mexico, wherever it might be, to get it. And by the way, these are modern facilities. These aren't, you know, sort of primitive village. These are Western quality facilities with, you know, well-trained doctors. People get good care there. That's not a good outcome, but at the end of the day, that will put downward pressure on cost if a lot of people are getting these high-cost surgeries, procedures, other countries. So I don't think we will, those stories that we'll see these huge explosion costs, I don't think those are plausible. How exactly it's reined in, I can't say at this point, but I think it will be.
You kind of explained, if I heard correctly, that the fiscal cliff was in a way created, and I would say it's created a lot of fear. Would you say that, or I guess what would you say the end was that the people had in mind as far as maybe the media? Do you think they had an intent to affect the market somehow or just wanted something to report on?
Well, there's a couple things. First off, I mean, I don't think it was deliberately created in the sense that all these things would happen at the same time. I don't think, you know, they kind of fell into that. You know, so much of this was the sequester, for example. You had this long, tense budget negotiation over the raising of debt ceiling. You know, obviously they knew on the calendar, you know, this all kicks in January. Everyone knew that. But, you know, I don't think they deliberately did that. That was just what you ended up agreeing to at the end of the day. Same year with the extension of the payroll tax cut for a year. You know, you had a fight. You know, people wanted to go home for Christmas. This was done in December last year. This is what they could agree to. You know, so, I everyone knows the calendar, but I don't think there was a conspiracy there. Where I think there is, you know, kind of this effort to hype it is, you know, twofold. One, you have, from the standpoint of people want to extend the tax cuts, they very much want to have a deal before the end of the year because they're on much better footing. This is exactly the political logic I was talking about a moment ago, that after January 1st, President Obama's in a situation where he could say, I want to give tax cuts to 98% of the people. Right now he's in a situation where he's saying, I want to raise taxes on 2%. So the politics of saying I want to give a tax cut to 98% is much, much better. People who do not want President Obama to be in that situation have a lot of reason to say, oh, disaster, disaster. We can't possibly let that happen. You know, so they have a reason. The other thing is that you have the story of the grand bargain. People probably heard about this. This is the idea that you're going to have, you know, this comprehensive package of spending cuts and tax increases. $4 trillion over the decade is the target they usually have. It involves cuts to Medicare, Social Security, a lot of domestic spending programs, and some tax increases. And you have a lot of people pushing for that. Washington Post just totally, you know, gung-ho on that, both the news section and opinion section. They want to force, you know, President Obama and Congress to come to something like their grand bargain before the end of the year because they're very worried that, you know, generally politicians take the shortest path, you know, the easiest path. Come January 1st, and President Obama goes, okay, I want to have tax cuts for 98% of the people. That's the easiest path. So if they could try to say, no, that's not an acceptable outcome, well, President Obama doesn't want to just say, okay, I'm going to go along with, you know, extending the Bush tax cuts, you know, for another year, 2 years, or indefinitely for everyone. He ran on the opposite, so it'd be hard for him to do that. So they're hoping they could force, you know, create pressure that you get a deal before the end of the year, and it looks something like their grand bargain, rather than just extending the Bush tax cuts. So those are two distinct groups that, you know, pushing in slightly different directions, but they both have a reason to hype this January 1st deadline.
Hello, my name is Ryan Farron. So do you think that a nationalized healthcare system is the best option to fix this issue?
Well, let me put it this way. There are many different nationalized healthcare systems. So you have systems like you have in the UK and Denmark and several other countries where it's literally provided by the government. Those tend to be cheap, lower cost. You know, there are complaints about those. I won't claim to be an expert. You know, they do things cheaply where they always do things as well as they could. You know, arguable point. You have a system like Canada, which is like our Medicare system. In fact, they call it Medicare, where it's provided almost entirely. I mean, I'm sure there's some public hospitals there, as we do here, almost entirely through the private sector, paid for by the government. Gets rid of a huge amount of administrative expense. I mean, that's, you know, one of the most obscene things is the administrative expense of our system, that it's, you know, the insurers themselves take out 15 to 20% of, you know, what goes to them, goes to cover, you know, their administrative costs, their sales teams, you know, reviewing bills, other profits, of course. Just enormous waste. They're just really obscene. So if you can get rid of that, that's a really big thing. Other things, you know, as I say, we have incredibly irrational system providing care that I was talking a moment ago about drugs. You could tell the same sort of story about with medical devices. I mean, this is one of these things that as an economist, it just kind of amazes me because if you look at the trade literature, there's God knows how many articles about, you know, the cost to the economy of tariffs on shirts and suits or shoes. You go, okay, well, with prescription drugs, we have the government gives drug companies patent monopolies. And rather than being like a tariff that might raise the price of this suit by 20% or 30%, they raise the price like 10,000%. Drugs are cheap. You know, you can go and get generic drugs at chain drugstores, you know, $6, $7, $8 a prescription. The drugs that you'll spend hundreds of dollars or sometimes even thousands of dollars for per prescription, they aren't hard to manufacture. That's simply because someone has a monopoly. And if it's a monopoly on a drug you need for your health or even your life, a cancer drug, you're going to pay it if you can. If your insurance company covers it, or you'll pay that. That's you know, so what does the economics say about that? Well, when you create a huge gap between the cost of production and the price, well, you're going to get all sorts of distortions in the market. You'll get things like drug companies lie. Imagine that. You know, if you read the Times, the New York Times, they have good coverage on this. I doubt you'll see a month go by where there's not a story where a drug company misrepresented either the safety or the effectiveness of its drug. They have an enormous incentive. They're going to sell a drug for $500 that costs them $5 to get to the market. So I would say an incredibly inefficient healthcare system. The insurance industry is probably the biggest part of that. Drug sector, a close second. Medical equipment, third. We use way too many specialists. I don't know how many times you get sent to a specialist when in any other country a primary care physician could deal with it, you know, just fine. So there's a lot of things you could point to, but I think certainly going to a system like the Canadian system would be an incredible improvement over what we have. Okay, probably time for one more question.
Thanks again for being here. I was just curious, you kind of alluded to the fact that you think that just by the nature of cutting government spending that you think that would slow the growth of the economy. What is it that you support in terms of spending against taxes and I guess the Bush tax cuts, how do you feel about those? Do you feel like we should have a more progressive tax code or where's the balance there with continuing to grow the economy but yet dealing with the highly politicized issues of spending and taxes?
Well, that's a simple question. Well, the Bush tax cuts were overwhelmingly skewed towards wealthier people, so I'd certainly like to see the taxes increase on higher-end people, you know, the 2%, top 2%. Other changes to the tax system, I mean, I'm a huge fan of financial speculation taxes because, you know, the financial sector is hugely bloated, and it's a tax that could raise huge amounts of revenue. There's a very modest tax that was proposed by Senator Harkin and Peter DeFazio, scored as raising about $40 billion a year in revenue. You could have larger taxes. Japan had a tax in place that raised 1% GDP. That would be $160 billion a year in revenue. And part of my reason for liking it isn't just the revenue it raises. You'd be reducing a lot of speculation. This is just wasted activity, people shuffling paper back and forth. And we know it's overwhelmingly wasted activity because if you had a really productive trade, say you have a tax on buying and selling stock of 0.25%, if you expected to get a gain of more than that, you go ahead and do the trade. Okay, so that would be a really good way to raise revenue. In terms of spending, I mean, I don't want spending for its own sake. It's, you know, we've had a lot of cutbacks in state and local governments primarily, areas that I think probably are needed. You know, some of these have been in public safety and education, you know, things that are certainly needed. Certainly, we've done a horrible job in preparing our infrastructure. I mean, the Hurricane Sandy, I mean, that's an example. I mean, we're always going to have storms, and we can't be perfectly prepared, but we are far from well prepared. So we could be doing a lot of things that would be money very well spent. But sort of the short-term story is that we have this big gap in demand that we can only fill from the government sector. Once we get the trade deficit down, which is not going to happen overnight, that's the story, you have to get the dollar down, they'll get the trade deficit down. Once we get the trade deficit down, then we could look to having something closer to a balanced budget. But until then, basically, insofar as we reduce the deficit, what we're going to be doing is raising the unemployment rate, which I can't say is a good thing. One last thing I'll just say that, you know, I think is a great model. If we can't do it by generating more demand, in other words, we can't get back to full employment by generating more demand, there's a great alternative path that Germany really is the poster child of, and that's work sharing. A lot of people look at Germany, people aren't familiar, Germany's unemployment rate today is something like 5.4%. And that's really striking because before the downturn, it was something like 7.8%. So in other words, its unemployment rate is actually like something like 2.5 percentage points below what it was when they went into the recession. Now, a lot of people look at them and they go, oh, well, Germany is booming. Well, actually, no. Germany's growth has been about exactly the same. I mean, we'd have to look at the third quarter numbers. But it's been almost exactly the same as the growth in the U.S. So why is it that our unemployment rate went up by 3.5 percentage points? Their unemployment rate went down by 2.5 percentage points. Well, Germany gives companies incentives to keep people on the payroll. They work shorter hours, but they keep them on the payroll, work sharing. We have that in the U.S. It's not widely taken advantage of. It's part of the unemployment systems in 25 states. And actually, the Obama administration had a provision in the bill that extended the payroll tax cut that gave states an enormous incentive to expand their work-sharing programs because the federal government will pick up the tab through 2013 and 2014. Seems no one's done that. But, you know, in any case, if we can't boost demand, you know, either through spending increases, tax cuts, I'd love to see more work sharing because, you know, the worst part of the story, I mean, it's bad, you know, if you could say, okay, there are things we could be doing. We have workers that want to work. We could be building up our infrastructure, providing better education. I'd like to see us do that. But if for whatever reason, we don't have the political will to do that. I'd love to say, okay, so why don't we work fewer hours rather than lay people off? Why don't we have everyone work 10% fewer hours? They get some cut in pay, but that's got to be better than being laid off. It's a much better way to go, and I actually could say with some certainty that you actually have some Republican support for that because that provision got through with Republican support. I worked with some of the Republicans on that. So if that's where the room for compromise exists, I'd love to see us go there.
This concludes today's Hinckley Forum. Please join me in thanking Dean Baker for an excellent forum.